Jung Institute in Zurich. His educational background includes degrees in science and journalism. He is the author of The Secret Raven, Conflict and Transformation, which is about these same processes in the life and work of Franz Kafka. Among many institutes and associations, he is a member of the International Association of Analytical Psychology and the National Society for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. He is also a director of this foundation. I have pleasure in introducing Darrell Sharp.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank the unknown admirer who left the flowers at the foot of the podium. Well, our subject tonight is the psychology of relationship. And to simplify my presentation, which is merely a preliminary few remarks leading into our discussion period, which, as you may remember, I enjoy much more than standing up here telling you what I think. I much prefer to have something to respond to from you. But with any luck, I will leave enough space for questions, and we will have lots to discuss after our break. I'm going to concentrate on relationships mainly between two persons of whatever sex. I will speak of the psychological dynamics involved in relationships from the point of view of Jungian psychology in general and Jung's model of the psyche in particular. This will involve some consideration of the psychological mechanism known as projection, which, simply speaking, is the predisposition of the individual psyche to experience personal characteristics as if they were outside of oneself. For instance, as a loved or disliked characteristic of someone else. I would like you to keep in the back of your minds two very important questions. The first is, what is the difference between relationships based on projection and those characterized by psychological separation? And the second is, when is love or hate not just projection? Those two questions again. What is the difference between relationships based on projection and those characterized by psychological separation? And when is love or hate not just projection? Perhaps we will find in the course of this evening that these two questions have essentially the same answer. I also want to make it clear at the outset that I'm not speaking ex cathedra. I'm not speaking from a position of invulnerability or any lofty height from which I have everything figured out. What I will say this evening comes not only from what I've read in Jung, who has made quite an impression on me at certain points in my life, but also and particularly from what I've learned by being involved in a series of absolutely disastrous relationships. A few not so bad, and several current relationships that are very good indeed. I have to say, too, that without a few years of intensive personal analysis and a profound respect for what Jung calls the reality of the psyche, relationships would, on the whole, still be a complete mystery to me. Now, the alternate title to this talk is Receiving the Other. I chose this phrase some time ago, and I finally remembered why I had chosen that, because it describes very well what does not happen in most relationships. To receive an other, you have to recognize that there is one. And until we have differentiated ourselves from those we love or hate, we are all too often in a state of psychological identification with them. This is what projection is all about. In a relationship based on projection, we do not see or hear the other person as a distinct and separate individual. Instead, we see or hear an aspect of ourselves, or what we want to hear, or what we would say or do if we were in the other person's shoes. Much well-meaning advice is misguided or completely beside the point, because it simply does not apply to the psychological reality of the other person, but only to ourselves. Our expectations of another person are out of place when they are not based on the separate and recognized reality of that other person. Our personal hurt and pain, our hurt feelings and disappointments are inevitable when the other person exists, so to speak, only in our own minds. The consequences of projection are everywhere, ranging from the hurt silence to family breakup to murder. In fact, it is wishful thinking to describe most of our projective interactions as relationships, because without the recognition and acceptance of a separate other person to relate to, there are no genuine relationships, only varying degrees of power. I have here a passage from one of Jung's early seminars in the 30s, where he speaks of the connection between projection and identification. Identification, you may know, he also calls participation mystique. Here he gives a practical example. When a person complains that he is always on bad terms with his wife or the people whom he loves, and that there are terrible scenes or resistances between them, you will find when you analyze this person that he has had an attack of hatred. He has been living in participation mystique with those he loves. He has spread himself over other people until he has become identical with them. And that is a violation of the principle of individuality. Then they have resistances naturally in order to keep themselves apart. I say, of course, it is most regrettable that you always get into trouble, but don't you see what you are doing? You love somebody, you identify with them, and of course you prevail against the object of your love and repress him or her by your very self-evident self-identity. You handle him as if he were yourself, and naturally there will be resistances. It is a violation of the individuality of that person, and it is a sin against your own individuality. Those resistances arise from a most useful and important instinct. You have resistances, scenes, and disappointments so that you may become finally conscious of yourself, and then hatred is at an end. That ends the passage from Jung. To look at this from a slightly different angle, let us acknowledge that there is in each of us, on the one hand, always the need to communicate, the need to achieve union with another person, even so much as to fuse with another person. But let us also recognize the opposite need, to be separate, to have one's own boundaries, one's independent freedom. These are conflicting needs in each of us. In a relationship, the mutual fulfilling can be a most satisfying experience, but the conflicting tendencies can be hell. In any close relationship, there is inevitably frustration. and the ability both to tolerate frustration and to inflict it on another person without too many guilt feelings is one notable sign of a psychologically mature person. Now, the need to achieve union with another person is what might be called an archetypal need. That is, it has existed in all persons in every culture, though it may manifest in many different ways. In our own North American society, its realization is embedded in the ideal popularly known as togetherness. In terms of relationship, we are caught in this ideal, to our acknowledged horror, whenever we feel diminished, less whole, lacking energy and lust for life, unless our loved one is literally present. Last week I came across an interview with the American actress Elizabeth Ashley. She's quoted as saying, "I think togetherness destroys more relationships than anything else. But we're so processed to believe that presence is a proof of love, and love has become an ego sport." Miss Ashley is saying here what it took me about 5 years of analysis to realize. Namely, that a relationship based on this ideal of togetherness with another person is totally unworkable. Such an ideal actually makes a genuine relationship impossible. In any starry-eyed or passionate relationship based on this apparent complete fulfillment of one's potential wholeness is doomed to degenerate into animosity and acrimony, if not eventually physical separation, which may indeed be the best thing that could happen, at least for a time, if a relationship is to survive at all. Yet the notion of togetherness is profoundly valuable, it seems to me, when it is applied to the individual psyche. Get yourself together, we say, to someone hurting when a love affair has turned sour. And rightly so, for togetherness in this sense has as its focus one's own unique psychology. To get oneself together in psychological terms is to get to know one's own personal complexes, what they look like and what activates them, and to take responsibility for them. In the process, we may also realize that at the root of any relationship problem, there is our own fragmented personality. It is true that others too are fragmented, but that is their responsibility, not ours. They are as free to take themselves seriously or not as we are. If we choose to be with another person, let it be because of what and who they are, not because we can't live without them or because there is no one else. If our goal is to change the so-called loved one into someone else, someone we'd rather be with, then let us ask ourselves what this has to do with the other person, and if perhaps it has more to do with ourselves and some potential or characteristic or unlived life of our own that has yet to be realized. This applies equally and perhaps especially to the expectations we all have of our own children. I have 4 of them myself, ranging from 2.5 to 23, and I don't claim to be immune from this kind of projection. Sometimes our expectations are conscious, or relatively so, and based on an intuitive awareness of our children's future possibilities according to the qualities they undeniably possess. Then, of course, our expectations are an appropriate challenge and can give a child a sense of identity to measure up to. More often, I'm afraid, we do not see the other person, especially our own children, that clearly. If on top of this we do not see ourselves clearly either, then the possibilities for projection and consequently disastrous relationships are virtually limitless. I want to put on the blackboard here Jung's model of what is going on psychologically in any relationship between two persons. For the sake of simplicity, I'm going to assume the relationship is between persons of the opposite sex. Jung's model is based on at least two basic assumptions or working hypotheses. The first is that there are both conscious and unconscious parts or contents in any individual psyche. And the second is that the unconscious of a man has a feminine quality and the unconscious of a woman has a masculine quality. These are what is called the contrasexual elements in the individual. In case these assumptions are unacceptable, then of course Jung's model has no value at all. But I shall assume that they are palatable to you for the moment. Some of you may recognize this diagram that Jung uses in his long essay, Psychology of the Transference. There he calls it the marriage quaternio, or cross-cousin marriage, taken from anthropological case histories. Now, this is a very simple drawing. Jung used it to describe the possibilities of relationships between two persons. If it isn't too much to swallow that there is a conscious and unconscious side to each of us, then it seems fairly obvious that this admits of the possibilities that Jung refers to. Line A at the top with the arrows on each end, if a relationship is conducted along this line, so to speak, then it is a fairly uncomplicated relationship, ego man to ego woman. Now, there's a line of communication also going between the ego and the unconscious of each person. This is going on all the time, of course. Whether consciously or not, we are always talking to ourselves. We may not formally personify our contrasexual side and address him or her by name, But that is in effect what we're doing whenever we look closely at ourselves and ask ourselves what kind of hot water we've got into this time. Now, relationship based along the line or axis C, the unconscious of one person to the unconscious of another, is really the most prevalent kind of relationship that exists. That is where you have people who are quite ordinary and untutored in psychological complexities. This is the rule and not the exception. People who meet and fall in love are falling in love because of what is going on between one unconscious and the other. Now, when that happens, what you have is very much like a bowl of soup, where the woman that the man is in love with is indistinguishable from the woman who is his contrasexual side in his own unconscious, and vice versa. The man, either he resembles the woman's animus, or she tries to turn him into that. And you see that often when a woman marries someone who, to everyone else, does not look anything like her original model of a man, her father, but one can see that that's what she's trying to turn him into. And the same with the man, of course. His original devotion and loyalty is due to his mother, and once he leaves her, his automatic inclination, instinctive inclination, is to turn any other woman into his mother. Now, it may not be true if he has a very negative mother, but on the whole, I think it's quite clear that most men, consciously or unconsciously, require a lot of mothering. All relationships are based to some extent on projection. There's nothing wrong with this, because there are many facets of our personalities which would be hidden from us forever if we did not have an opportunity to experience them in projection. Interaction with other people inevitably constellates our complexes. We know that a complex has been constellated or activated whenever we have a strong emotional reaction to what another person says or does. When that happens, we can blame the way we feel on that other person, with all the well-known consequences, or we can ask ourselves why we should have such a reaction. In the process of paying close attention to ourselves instead of judging and blaming others, we may find that we are not entirely who we thought we were, for better or for worse. Relationships from this point of view are therefore essential for what Jung has called the individuation process. Now, alongside the need to be emotionally close to another person, there is what one might call the drive toward individual wholeness. These are the part of the conflicting tendencies I referred to earlier, which, unless recognized, will certainly muddle a relationship. Ideally, there will be space in a relationship for both of these tendencies. According to Jung's model of the psyche, and implicit in his whole concept of individuation, the process of becoming conscious involves, on an intrapsychic level, the line of communication labeled B. This means getting to know what is going on in your unconscious, including what is behind your emotional reactions, as well as differentiating your own conscious ego from your contrasexual side. Unless you do this to some extent, you are bound to confuse your anima or animus with with the woman or the man in your life. And there, in a nutshell, is the root of much of the confusion that prevails in relationships. Because individual wholeness is necessarily and by definition an intrapsychic process, unless this is consciously worked on, that wholeness is inevitably projected into the outer relationship. Then our feeling of being whole or not depends on both the physical and emotional closeness with the other person. And as often as not, their undivided attention and devotion, if not actually their constant physical presence. This would be the psychological explanation of jealousy. You can readily see how such dependence limits the freedom of the other person. Now, in contrast to the popular ideal of togetherness, let us just look briefly at the concept of psychological separation and what effect this can have on a relationship. Psychological separateness, incidentally, is really, by extension, an inescapable consequence of following Jung's views. Psychological separation is a sine qua non of consciousness. If you are psychologically separate, it means you know your own boundaries, where you end and someone else begins. But you cannot, of course, be separate in this sense until and unless you have developed the inner strengths that initially you may depend on another person for. That is the daily work of personal analysis, in case one has not accomplished that task while growing up. The more work you do on yourself, the more you are able to accept that the other person is a separate and distinct human being with needs and characteristics that are or may be quite different from your own. This immediately creates a space between you and other people in general, not only those you love. And this, of course, has its consequences, not all of them welcome. For if you don't make an effort to fill this space with something personally meaningful, then that space can easily become loneliness and drive you back to other people just for the sake of filling the emptiness. Then you're right back where you started. On an imaginary horizontal scale, we could put narcissism at one end and psychological integration at the other. On that note, then, I'm going to stop and see what comes up during the question period. Thank you.
Should we take a break now, Darrell?
Yes, we'll take a break in 10 or 15 minutes. Respond to any of your questions. Who has something pressing to ask? Yes.
Where does the shadow appear in the diagram you have on the board?
Well, in this particular diagram, it doesn't actually appear because it would be part of a man's unconscious. For my, well, in that it is on the drawing, but what, that's a good question. Okay. Let's say that it was a man and man on each side, not man and woman. Then if we want to understand what is going on psychologically, we would have the unconscious at the bottom of each side, and instead of anima and animus in brackets, we would have anima and anima in brackets. There is also a little known concept called the animus of the anima. If you can swallow that, then the animus in a man's unconscious is that aspect of his own masculinity that he is not, has not consciously integrated. And he is just as liable to project that onto another man as he is likely to project his soul image or anima onto a woman. And that can result in adulation for another man or animosity. Pardon? Well, that's where, on this diagram, that's where a man would be responding to the masculine side of a woman. You see, according to Jung's model, the shadow of any individual is the same sex. So you tend to project your shadow onto a person of the same sex. It wouldn't be a shadow problem of the woman, because her shadow problem would turn up in her relationships with other women. It might be stretching things a bit, but theoretically, I guess one could say that a man's shadow problem could be constellated by dealing with a very masculine woman. But more likely, it will come out with authority figures in his life. Professor Davies?
I may have misunderstood what you said earlier, but if I heard you correctly, you said that a man in his search for a woman was looking for something that was the image of his mother. Surely that's rather unadventurous.
Yes, well, that's well said. The hero's fight is to conquer the dragon. He is no hero who, having seen the dragon, goes home to mother. And I certainly agree with you, to settle for mothering from those you supposedly love is not very adventurous. But that's the way it is. to be adventurous, you have to be prepared to meet Humbaba in the big forest. And there aren't a lot of heroes left, except on the silver screen. Yes? Well, that's a very good point, and that happens, it seems to me, or at least one way to understand why that happens, it obviously happens, we see it every day, is that a man is not, if he is not aware that he wants and needs mothering, will unconsciously demand it from the woman he's close to. And when she gives it to him, because it's the only way to get him in a good mood, he will resent it because he's not aware that that's what he wants. What he wants, he thinks, is a mistress. That's what he thinks he wants. What she realizes and is aware that he wants, often, is mothering. And there's a lot of confusion there. The only way that can be unraveled is by one or both of them doing some detailed personal work on themselves to understand why they have such violent reactions to each other. Failing that, then there's no hope. Yes.
Carol, could you describe in some detail a relationship D and relationship C? How does that manifest?
D and C?
D and C.
They're on different directions.
First D and then C.
Well, let me start with C. C is what I was... I like the beginning of the alphabet. C is that unconscious relationship when one is... just identified with the world around. That's a very primary way of dealing with the world, and a child is like that. A child, to begin with, does not differentiate him or herself from the immediate surroundings, I mean other people. And that degree of identification exists between mother and child for much longer than it does between the child and anybody else in its environment. I mean, a grown-up relationship based on that can be nothing, cannot last long because it will burn itself out. You have only one unconscious responding to the other, and the conscious side of the individual is not functioning in the relationship. So typically you would get have a strong magnetic attraction between two people who can't stand each other, who say they can't stand each other. But given the slightest opportunity, and they fall into each other's arms. That's an unconscious relationship on that lower axis. The only way they can understand it would be to try to find out what they're not conscious of in themselves that they are so mysteriously attracted to in the other person. The D lines, well, on a woman's side, if she is not conscious of her masculine side, then she will tend to experience it in the outside world, in the men in her life. if a woman who has not, for instance, developed her own intellect or her own creativity will tend to idolize and worship those who have, men. I mean, those men who have. She may also know some women who are creative and do the same thing. You see, the beauty of this model is you can have women on at both sides of that. Of that relationship. It works equally well as a way of understanding what is going on psychologically. But the beauty of it for me is that it so graphically shows the possibilities, and it is up to the individual who wants to understand what is going on in their relationships to figure out which, in any particular relationship, which way they're functioning. Now, it's primary in from my point of view, and to have a good relationship, it is a primary task to differentiate one's conscious sense of oneself from that contrasexual side. Otherwise, you are constantly looking for it outside.
What was the it, looking for it outside?
That unconscious side of yourself.
If you don't find it within yourself, you certainly...
Well, if you don't realize what it is, if you're not conscious of the quality or the nature, the characteristics of your own contrasexual side, and this can vary with every individual. You know, some men need mothers. Some men, we all need mothers, but we need particular kinds of mothers, and that makes particular demands on the women that we have relationships with. And it varies. This is a general model, but without being specific about the type of characteristic that is projected on the person of the opposite sex. And if we have an unconscious need for something and it is not fulfilled by the significant other person in our lives, then that can lead to resentment because we unconsciously ask for it to be fulfilled. That distorts the freedom of the other person to be who he or she is, and of course then you get a constant, the attraction and then the repulsion because the needs are not met. The problem is in expecting needs to be met from the outside world that can only be met by a rapprochement with the inner person. Yes. I don't know what you mean.
In other words, what advantage would a person have to enter into a relationship unless there were some projections that you met or hopefully met?
Well, projection is something that happens. It's not something that is fulfilled. It's something that automatically happens. According to Jung's view of the psyche, anything that we are unconscious of can be met outside, and we can have a relationship with that outside, and it will have a certain magnetic attraction if it is something important within our own psyche as well. Yes.
In your view, did the potency of the contrasexual vary from individual to individual, or a law of equal quantity?
Well, some of us are more volatile than others. The potency, you said. I mean, theoretically, everyone is potentially conscious. It takes a lot of motivation to do the amount of work that is necessary to become even minimally aware of what's going on in yourself. And a lot of people don't have that motivation. Disastrous relationships often provide that motivation, if they don't break you entirely. Oh, I don't know. I don't know that.